Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am Brett King, your host. Breaking Banks is the number one global fintech radio show, 177 countries, 6.6 million unique listens we're on track for this year. It's huge, as Donald Trump would say, or Bernie Sanders says it as well. But joining me today as my co-host is my good pal, JP Nichols. JP.
Yep, hello. Glad to be back, as always.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like you're back. It's sort of like you're just here, right? Because you're here pretty consistently. So we have got some great stuff for you guys today. We're going to talk about some of the huge conferences coming up next week, Money 2020 and Sibos. We're going to deep dive into InnerTribe. We have Shamir Karkal on talking about his new startup shortly. But before that, let's get to the news and conference announcements. So, first up in the news, the big news I noticed was MasterCard has announced they're doing away with the signature panel. This is huge. Like, this has been sitting around for 30 years, but it does signal the end, finally, of the dominance of the signature as a mechanism for identity. Let's face it, folks. Signature is not secure. It's easily corrupted and copyable. It's a first century artifact. It has no place in modern financial services. And you certainly can't compete in real time if you require a signature on a piece of paper to certify a credit card or debit card transaction or apply for a financial services product. So it's good to see finally we see some majors eliminating the signature formally as part of this stack. JP, well, what do you think about the news?
Oh, I was just going to say you have been beating this drum for a long time.
For a long time. Yeah.
From my perspective, just as a consumer and as a user of those little pieces of plastic, it's funny that this timing comes up because last week I had two notable transactions, a $300-some transaction that required no signature, and appropriately so. It was a chipped card. And at the same time, the hotel I was in Orlando last week for BAI, every time I went down to the little store for my, $3 banana and iced tea in the morning. I had a sign for the, for the $3 transaction, even though it's a chip, not chip and pin, but still the signature adds nothing. Chip and SIG, the SIG adds zero value.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So that's good to see finally that we've got the signature, going the way of the dodo finally. Westpac has launched a RegTech challenger, a RegTech challenge for startups in Australia. That's pretty interesting. There's a lot of stuff happening in the payment space. So the UK is looking for vendors to do their new UK payment system. We, of course, have the FPS, Faster Payment System, that launched in Hong Kong last week. So lots of good action there. In terms of conference announcements, a couple I've got, and JP, you might have some as well. But one is, of course, October the 30th and 31st coming up at the end of this month, after Money 2020 and Sibos, is the FinTech Talents event hosted in London. It promises to be a big event, one of the biggest FinTech events in the UK. And, of course, our good friend Liz Lumley is going to be heavily involved in that. So go along and check out FinTech Talents and say hello to Liz. Secondly, one for a little bit later, early next year, April 10 and 11, Seamless Middle East, their payments conference. So make sure you check that out also there. Do you have any to add, JP?
Well, no specific announcements, but I just will announce that I'll be in Hong Kong week after next, the 29th and 30th of October at Finovate Asia. So always happy to take the stage at Finovate, and I'll come back and talk about Money 2020 a little bit as we get to that part of the show a little bit later today.
And of course, our good friend Jim will be there in Money 2020 with you. We'll talk about that in a moment. And I will be, of course, at Cybos at InnerTribe doing the opening keynote down there for Swift at their Cybos conference. About 8,000 people going to be there this year, so a nice big event. If you are there at Cybos in Sydney, make sure you come and say hello. We will have the Breaking Banks booth, and we'll be doing some recording for future shows. So you might have your chance to get on the air on Breaking Banks. But now let's move to our special guest for today. Good friend, good pal of mine. Of course, you may know Shamir from his time as the co-founder and CFO at Simple, previously called Bank Simple. He then moved on to BBVA as part of their acquisition of Simple. And he's just launched his new startup. So, Shamir Kakal, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Shamir must have stumbled onto his mute button while we were there, while he's finding the unmute part. You know, it's interesting. I think about Shamir and Josh at Simple and your time at Movin. We should have had Jason Henricks on the show here, co-founder of Perk Street. Yeah, you were really all the original neobank people 10 years ago now, launching parts of this revolution.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I used to get asked all the time, and we'll let Shamir comment on this when he gets himself sorted, I used to get asked that all the time whether we competed, how we competed with Simple. But, you know, Josh and Shamir and I had met each other before Movin started and had talked about strategy on that respect. And then we became good friends. And we used to go back and forth and chat with each other quite openly about some of the challenges we were facing. And when we were launching Movin, I was getting advice from both Josh and Shamir on our approach with Movin. It was very collaborative. Oh, you're back.
I am back. I'm sorry. You're right. I did manage to hit the mute button somehow and took me a few seconds to pick that up. But you're right. I do remember those early days at Simple, and then of course at Movin, which was almost the same time. And then it was so funny because so many people would ask us if we were competing, and I would be like, really? It felt like we were all part of this small band of brothers, really, going up against the massive incumbents. And you know, it was all about sort of getting customers from, you know, Bank of America or Chase or Wells, not really sort of competing against each other. And I think that's still the case. There's been so much growth in the fintech space, and so much has happened, but we still have a long, long way to go. And the revolution has begun, but it's far from finished.
But absolutely,
I wanted to say thank you for having me on the show again. It's a pleasure.
No, it's great to have you back. It's a long time between drinks. It's been a while since you've been on. So, of course, you went to BBVA after the Simple acquisition, and you headed up the API team there. And maybe you can explain that transition, how you got to your new startup, Scylla, explain the evolution of from your perspective.
Completely. And I had either the privilege or the bad luck, depends on your point of view, of kind of being the banking guy at Simple. When Josh wanted to ask questions about banking in 2009, I was the closest thing to a banker that he knew. So that's why he started asking me. And then he suggested that we should start Simple together. And, you know, that's where that journey began. And the hardest problem at Simple was actually just building and launching it. Of course, finding customers and getting to product market fit was not easy, but it was the breaking into banking is not easy at all, and that of course is the gating factor to before you can actually break the banks. It took us about 2.5 years from quitting our jobs to actually fully launching Simple, a long journey with many twists and turns, of which we Brett and I have chatted about before. After the acquisition in 2014, I was in Madrid meeting the team of Carlos Torres, who's now the CEO, and somebody mentioned this idea of building an API platform. And my immediate reaction was, yes, somebody needs to do it, because there's this massive need for open API platforms in banking, and BBVA is clearly one of the most visionary banks out there, and has, you know, this this visionary leadership from Francisco Gonzalez and Carlos Torres. But my comment to them was like, please do it right. Don't screw it up, because it's not easy to do it right. And they asked me to, they spun up an internal ventures team on that project, and then asked me to be an advisor to that team. And I wrote some documents for them. And, you know, fast forward a year later, and I was running it. I think it was a great team of people. It was a great project that we put together. We ended up launching the API platforms for BBVA in Spain and then in the US. They're still up and running. There's customers on them, and they're growing nicely. But what became clear to me was that really going out and transforming the world of banking and finance within the context of a large bank was going to be pretty much impossible. And it's no knock on BBVA. I love the people there and the leadership. But when you're part of a massive bank with, you know, 800 billion plus assets, you just run into a whole host of challenges, internal compliance and things like that. Which it's just
a normal kind of big bank legacy stuff, right?
Exactly. And BBVA, I think, is the best of them all, but it can't change what it is.
In Bank 4.0, I don't know whether you've seen it yet, but in Bank 4.0, I actually write about the structure of the leadership team at BBVA and why it's sort of a model for other banks looking to become more technology focused. And I compare them with another major, I compare them quite kindly compared to this other major. I'll leave that there as an Easter egg, but it is in the second last chapter of the book. So I gave him a good shout out. So
yeah, completely. And I remember reading that section. And I won't dive into it because, as you said, we leave it as an Easter egg for the readers to find. But to me, that was a little bit frustrating, because what I wanted to see was, I wanted to go out and serve all the guys in their garages or basements building fintech startups and banks across the world, right? And it was frustrating to not be able to serve so many of them because of that sort of context of a large bank. So I ended up leaving BBVA late last year and then started trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and started looking much more deeply at the cryptocurrency space. And what struck me about cryptocurrencies was the accessibility of the platforms, right? Literally anybody on the planet who has a decent computer can connect to the internet and download and run Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of the major platforms out there, which was revolutionary compared to how hard it is to get access to, like, you know, ACH in the US, for example. Yeah. At the same time, in the crypto world, you have a massive challenge. There isn't anything like a currency. I enjoy owning Apple stock, but I don't want to have my salary paid in Apple stock, and I don't want to pay my mortgage in Apple stock. And you have the same sort of problems with all the cryptocurrencies. They're highly volatile, and really they shouldn't be called currencies.
They're more like speculative asset classes at the moment.
Exactly. And that's fine for certain use cases, but that's not what you need if you're going to transform banking and finance, because what people want is a stable currency that they can use on a day-to-day basis. And so there's major challenges in the crypto world which people are trying to overcome, but at the same time the accessibility is sort of revolutionary. On the banking side, you have a lot of scalability, a lot of stable currencies, the dollar, for example, but accessibility is so hard. And that's the challenge we set out to solve with Scylla. What we're building is an API platform. It gives you the basic building blocks that you need to build a fintech app, KYC, linking a payments account like a bank account or a card, and then doing credits and debits to those payment accounts. But on the back end, we issue an ERC-20 token. It's a standard within Ethereum, which is what's called a stable coin. So it's pegged to the dollar, and we reserve that with 100% reserve held in US treasuries. And so essentially, it is a digital dollar. And the combination of that API platform plus the ERC-20 token kind of gives developers the ability to get access to the existing payment systems like ACH and card, which is what, you know, everybody on the planet has, and at the same time gives them an on-ramp and an off-ramp into the cryptocurrency world, where they can build smart contracts and build and take advantage of that massive functionality and all the tooling available there, but use a stable token that's, you know, that's basically just a digital dollar. And that's kind of the capability that we want to unlock. And we think it will revolutionize both the fintech and the crypto space by making it possible for developers to get apps to end customers much, much more quickly. You know, we're talking about from getting an idea to shipping it to your five friends within a week instead of like the years that it took Josh and I at Simple.
So is this focused on just the developer side, or with both internally and externally within the banks, or where do the banks fit into this? Because as you talk about BBVA and others who are now launching open banking in the U.S., what about those banks that aren't going to be able to build their own infrastructure? Are they going to be able to leverage your platform for that?
I want to keep this platform as open and as accessible as possible. So that is absolutely no, you know, I'm not stopping any bank from kind of using the platform if they want to. But honestly, I expect that most of the usage will come from developers who are working at small or medium-sized startups. The problem for banks tends to be so much of it is tied up in their internal culture. And, you know, most of the small to mid-sized banks out there don't even have a real dedicated development team. So they can't take advantage of APIs. And as for the large banks, they have much larger other issues, which, Brett, you've written about at length in your books. And for them, it's really about getting out of their own way more than anything else. There might be a few banks, I'd say a handful globally, like, for example, BBVA, with whom we might look at doing partnerships, because, of course, they have so many capabilities in so many different countries. But it's unlikely that we'll see much usage from banks even in the next few years, right? Who knows in the long term?
So it's sort of like it's like a really powerful sandbox that you know, not just prototype on. You can actually build, you know, production software out of the sandbox, right, with all these API hooks you've got.
Completely. You can build in our sandbox, test it, and then when you're ready to ship it to end customers. And then if you get, you know, if you start getting traction, then you'll need to scale it. And it's always possible that, you know, somebody who's building the next, I don't know, the next Digit or the next Venmo or the next Stash or whatever, might eventually decide that they need to go to some of the, you know, the traditional banks or whatever, purely because of scale. But that's, you know, that's on us, right? Like we at Scylla have to hold on to those customers as they scale. And we think we can do that and build a platform that that kind of becomes like, you know, the Twilio of finance. And really transforms the space.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left, Shamir. So I've got two things I want to get out of the way before we finish up. And the first is, what role does the stable coin play in this? Because I'm still not clear on that particularly. And the second is, of course, you know, where can people find out more information on Scylla?
Completely. The stable coin is just a way of like actually seeing the ledger of our ledger, right? Like when we debit or credit customers, we take those funds and hold them in the reserve pool. But the stable coin via the smart contract just gives you total insight into that. It is just a ledger, but it's a distributed ledger in Ethereum, which is publicly accessible and is totally transparent because you can see every transaction that's ever occurred, right? And because it's on Ethereum, it integrates into MetaMask and, you know, all the wallets and all the other tools that are being built on top of that. There's really, if you don't need it, you don't necessarily have to use it. And you can find out all of this and much more at scyllamoney.com. That's SILAMONEY.com, which is our website.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, I was just going to repeat it, SillaMoney.com. Shamir, thanks for joining us. We could go on, and we'll definitely have you back on the show, but we have some more great guests to get to, so thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
So that was Shamir Kakal talking about his new venture, and of course, you know, it's great to see Shamir having a second bite of the pie there after his success with Simple, and of course, that was acquired by BBVA. But now, what we want to do is we want to talk about next week. There's a whole bunch of activity going on globally in terms of major events. If you're in fintech, I'm sure you know about it. We've got Money 2020 out in Vegas, and JP, you're going to be out at Vegas, right?
Yes, I am. With our friends at Capital One, they're sponsoring another series this year as they did with us in the past. So they have some very cool things to talk about. And you are going to be down under.
Absolutely. I'm going to be in Sydney for Cybos, which we're going to get to in a moment. But of course, one of the other regulars, I guess we have to call him a co-host these days, Jim the Moose Maroose. is that right, JP? Did I get it right?
You did.
He's going to be back on the show. We always joke about my pronunciation of people's surnames on the show. He's going to be down in Vegas. He's doing a keynote down there. A bunch of, you know, Jason Hendricks is going to be there. Ron Shevlin's going to be there. A bunch of the Breaking Banks family is going to be there. So we will definitely get some content out of Money 2020 down there, thanks to the people at Cap One, but we will also be, we'll have a delegation down in Cybos at Sydney, where I'll be opening the Inner Tribe session there. And so to get a bit of scope of what's happening out at Cybos in Sydney this year, we've invited Kevin Johnson onto the show. Kevin, what is your formal title in respect to all of this?
So I'm the head of Inner Tribe for Swift.
Okay, so Inner Tribe is a part of the Swift or Cybos event, but can you just give us a landscape for those that aren't familiar with Swift, aren't familiar with Cybos and Inner Tribe? Can you explain all of this and why Cybos continues to be one of the largest financial services conferences globally?
Sure. So, for those who haven't heard of Swift, essentially, we are the payments backbone for wholesale banking around the world. We've got nearly 11,000 connected institutions on the network, and we're the network that is responsible for sending the money around the world when people buy companies, when mergers happen. Cross-border payments is kind of what we do.
So this is sort of mostly big bank-to-bank payments.
It's mostly, yeah, in the wholesale banking world, large corporate payments as well. So it's running that, the network that the banks run on top of. So it's the lifeblood of the financial industry.
Talk a little bit, Kevin, about InnoTribe. What was the origin of that? Who were some of the people that started that? And what's the purpose for InnoTribe as a part of Swift and a part of Cybos?
Okay, so we launched InnoTribe 10 years ago this year. It was launched by a group of innovators inside Swift who have since gone on to bigger and better things. One of the founders was a guy called Costa Peric. He was one of the key architects inside Swift on our technology side and really wanted to find a way to try and bring the whole financial community together to look at collaborative innovation. Since leaving InnoTribe, Costa's now actually heading up financial services for the poor for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, big financial inclusion drive.
Supporter of what we do.
He's doing incredible things over there.
He's doing some really amazing things that are actually making a real difference to a lot of people's lives. He's always been passionate in that sort of sphere, and it's, I always try and keep an eye out to what he's doing. He's making huge differences.
Who are some of the other alumni in the Inner Tribe team?
So if other sort of names in there, you've got Matteo Rizzi, who when he left, he ended up joining Sparebank Venture Capital. He's now running a company called Fintech Stage, who does a lot of fintech events, both in sort of emerged ecosystems, but also looking at sort of emerging innovation ecosystems and does a lot of work with Costa and the Gates Foundation. You've got Nektarios Glios, who joined Startup Bootcamp 5 years ago to launch Startup Bootcamp FinTech. And I see today that he's actually stepping down from that one.
I saw that. I wonder what he's doing next.
I have no idea. I think if you read his message, he's going to sort of take a bit of time and try and plan his next move out. So I think it's a case of watch that space for that one. I think it'd be really interesting to hear his journey. He literally took something that was an idea and is now a global institution, sort of leading the way forward for both startup and collaborative innovation within the industry as well.
Very cool.
You've got Mariella Atanasova. She was one of the sort of leaders bringing sort of graphical facilitation into what we do in the industry now. So a lot of the conferences you go for, you see people doing graphical facilitation and scribing. She brought that into InnoTribe 5 or 6 years ago, and she's leading a successful consultancy doing that sort of thing there. So there's been a lot of people that have come through that are either still inside the fintech ecosystem or close by to it, shaping it. But it's not just the people who are running it. It's InnoTribe is more than just the team. It's really about that much bigger network. The startups we work with, the bank innovation labs, the heads of innovation that we've worked with as well. And if I look back over the years, we've got companies such as TransferWise, who launched through InnoTribe. Revolut had one of their sort of first public showcases through InnoTribe as well. Vitalik Buterin, obviously right, Ethereum fame.
Yeah,
so he came and talked when we did Cybos in Boston 5 years ago. Just as he was launching his white paper then. So I wouldn't say he launched it at InnoTribe, but it was in and around that sort of time there. So there's been a lot of people coming through InnoTribe who, I suppose the best way to say it is, we try and capture topics that are going to be on a main stage of a conference in 3 to 4 years' time. So we're that sort of vehicle for both Swift as a company and as a community to look out ahead and try and understand what's coming down the pipe and what the impact and relevance of that would be to the financial industry to really help shape where we as an industry are going.
So you guys are an early stage conferencing organization.
Some people call it, if you look at the Edinburgh Festival, you've got the fringe on the side of it, which is kind of looking at the up and coming acts.
Fringe fintech.
So I think what we're trying to do is, not even fringe fintech. I think if you look back 10 years ago, fintech as such wasn't really around. It was kind of these people were working on the edges of the industry, working on the edges of the ecosystem. And what InnoTribe tried doing was actually bringing those two peoples together. So you had the large financial services players and the small innovative startups. And we wanted to show that there was a way that you could collaborate with these people.
Well, it's an amazing history. And I think the point was paying homage a little bit to some of those founders. And these are names that almost everybody in the industry knows. They're certainly friends of ours and friends of the show. But talk a little bit about where we go from here. So as we get ready for Cybos 2018, what should we look forward to? What are we going to see?
So I think if you look forward to this year, we're going beyond fintech. So one of the challenges at the moment, there's a lot of really good conferences doing a really good amount of work in the fintech space. And with a purview of trying to figure out what's coming next, we're going to start looking at some nascent technology that's out there and try and play that out. So we're actually taking a jump with Brett into the year 2030, into something he calls the augmented age, from his last book, Augmented. And really to try and understand what that will look like both from a societal level and then what the impact will be on the financial services landscape.
Well, that's great. So listen, I think we're going to pause here to take a short break, but we're going to be back with more Breaking Banks as we talk more about a preview of Cybos coming up next week in Sydney. So we'll be right back after this.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective, plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite host. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. Earlier in the week, we had a conversation with Kevin Johnson from Inner Tribe at Swift Cyber. And we were talking just before the break about all of the stuff that's going to happen at Inner Tribe and at the Cybos conference this year. So, Kevin, what's sort of the main theme overall of the conference?
So the main theme of Cybos itself is actually about digitization. So it's something that everybody in the industry is talking about. And what we're trying to sort of do is actually bring the practical ways that you can actually do this. So Cybos gathers 7,000 to 8,000 of the world's financial industry decision makers. So those real top tier bankers together in one place for a week, both to meet and network, but also to discuss and debate the big issues of the day. So it's really the place where if you want to meet the people who matter in our industry, it's where they come.
So it's not a fintech event per se. It is a real banking, corporate cash management, wholesale. It's a core banking event, right?
It completely is a core banking event. Cybos has actually been going for 40 years. So this is actually our 40th anniversary. And InnoTribe, the fintech side of this, we've only been doing this for 10 years. So we're kind of the new kids on the block.
So 2008 was the first InnoTribe. Where was that held? Do you remember?
It was actually before I joined the team. And if my memory serves me right, it was out in Asia. I think it was in Hong Kong.
I think, yeah, it was Hong Kong. And then the next year was Amsterdam, if I remember. But I remember, I remember being in Hong Kong at the time. I remember Chris Skinner saying, you've got to come along and join this Inner Tribe thing. And then in 2010 might have been Amsterdam, because I remember doing my book launch for Bank 2.0 there. Boy, that's years ago.
I think if you look back, I think you launched Moven with us as well.
We did, October 2011 in Toronto.
Yeah.
Where I did the closing keynote on the main stage as well, which was huge for me at the time. I was like, amazing opportunity. But so let's talk about Inner Tribe itself. What's the setup for Inner Tribe look like? You know, what sort of space have you created for Inner Tribe? Because that's always one of the real features of Cybos, is the Inner Tribe land.
So when we started creating it this year, I read a blog post from our stand designers, and they said the first thing to do before you sit down with the designer is understand your purpose. So really, it goes back to the Simon Sinek, the start with why. And I think the driving purpose behind Inner Tribe for the past 10 years has been about collaborative innovation. It's been about bringing people together. It's been about inclusivity. So we sat down and we had to think. One of the things we're trying to do this year is bring a lot more startup and fintech voices into Cybos. And to do that, we've created a kind of fintech city. And we've put the Inner Tribe stand at the heart of that city. And if you look at somewhere like New York and you say, let's go somewhere to meet, there's probably two or three places you'd meet. It'd be a coffee shop, it may be a party, or it might be a park. And we've kind of tried to create a little bit of a combination of all three. So the Inner Tribe stand this year is a very, very open park. It's got grass on the floor, it's got a big screen. We're partnering with Jimmy Monkey Coffee from Singapore, for the fourth year to sort of bring really high quality coffee into people. But it's really about a completely accessible space. If I look back over the past 3 or 4 years, we've had a spaceship on the floor. We've had a Colosseum. Last year, we created a coffee shop in Toronto. And this year, it's really about being a very, very open space that you can walk in and you can own. And it's a bit like Central Park in the middle of FinTech City.
The Colosseum was the I remember that was the blockchain year when blockchain launched, and we had standing room only for blockchain. Remember that?
That was actually the year before. So
was it the year before?
Yeah. So if you think about the sort of hype cycle of blockchain, Singapore was when we had our...
That's right.
Some people would have stated it was a white stand on white. 2 years before that, and actually about 4 or 5 years before that, we'd actually started talking about blockchain. And we realized that blockchain was moving from pure hype into a space where people were starting to experiment with it. So InnoTribe actually started taking a bit of a backward step. We did a session called New Kids on the Blockchain. We brought in people like Chain.com. We had Simon Taylor of Barclays at the time, now with 11FS on there. We had about 5 or 6 companies around that sort of space, chaired by a guy called Mark Boitinek from ING, who's one of the Swift board members as well, trying to really understand what this technology could do. At the time, it was packed inside the space. The overflow space had about 500 or 600 people on there as well. Everybody was really trying to understand what this was. And I think if you look now, blockchain has gone past that sort of hype of everybody talking about it into a space where everybody's actually starting to experiment with it, and you're starting to see some of the results coming out the other side of it.
Well, I think that's one of the cool things about InnoTribe. You have been on the early edge of a lot of things, and over the years and the few that I have been to, InnoTribe has become a bigger and bigger featured part. But it's not the only part. So there's lots of other things going on too. What are some of the things at the few rare times you can poke your head outside of the InnoTribe stage? What are you looking to see for the rest of the conference, Kevin?
I think the biggest buzz this year is going to be around AI, AI and robotics and data. It's something that we've covered in InnoTribe quite a lot, but I think you're starting to see people really grabbing hold of this technology and doing things with it. We're in Asia. So there's going to be a strong focus in China as well. And I think one of the key sort of other pieces is actually how all of this technology can come together and what it's actually going to do for the future. So it's not just a technology conference. It's not just a banking conference. It brings all of these themes through. I think that the three main themes, if you wanted to look at the conference for a whole, it would be around payments, it will be around cybersecurity, it'll be around compliance and financial crime compliance. But I think inside there's going to be a lot of interesting sessions showcasing really what the industry is looking at right now. So I think it's InnoTribe's taking that forward-looking view, saying what's coming down the road, and a lot of the other sessions are looking at what's happening now and how you can deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, we've got a couple of the presenters on, both on the main stage and in InnoTribe. So let's ask them to join us now. We have Duane Blomstrom, the author of Emotional Banking. Duane, how else would you like to introduce yourself now that you're back on the show?
Hi, hello, everyone. Yes, I guess that's number one thing to say. Second thing to say is I work for an exciting new company called People Not Tech, which I'm not going to tell you a lot about. We're still slightly in stealth, but suffice it to say, what we do is try and fix the entire issue of culture, whether it's in banking or other big organizations.
You're finally going to help us get rid of signatures.
Right. That's what it is.
All right. Well, when you guys are ready to come out of stealth, then this will be fantastic to hear. We also have Miss Metaverse joining us from New York, Katie King. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Hello.
Now, Katie,
you're having me back.
Yeah, you're a futurist. And, how would you classify the work you do?
So I am a futurist, and I have been working also in content marketing and social media. So that's been a strong focus of mine for several years now. I have a business called Futurism, and I work with a network of fellow futurists and also companies, organizations that that are all focused on the future and emerging tech. And I get to be a part of all those different worlds, which is really great. So I get to see how topics like the future of work are evolving, not only in, say, within the tech world itself, but also in fintech, which is great too.
And you used to run a YouTube channel with called Future Awesome Future TV, right?
Yeah, so my background is in film and television. I used to have a production company, and then I transitioned to going full futurist. I've always been creating content based on the future, and I eventually discovered futurism, and it was amazing. And I started creating content that was focused on futurism, and part of that was Awesome Future TV. And that was about 4 years ago. And then I started working on Futurista. That's been my main focus as of recently.
So you know the definition of a futurist, right?
Yes, I do.
It means never being wrong today. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's my little futurist joke. Yeah, okay, so, yeah, exactly. Before we get into the future of work session that you and Duana are both on, Duana, you're involved in Intertribe this year. What's your duties at Intertribe?
Well, I'm doing anchoring for the last day in Intertribe. The day is based on cyber and what that is going to look like in the future. And we're walking away from simply speaking about very expected topics in terms of cyber, and we're going very deep into what does that look like from an ethics perspective, what does that look like from a people perspective, and how does that all come together in terms of technology. So I'm really excited. There's some amazing speakers that I get to interview and ask difficult questions. There's some networking that we're looking forward to doing to answer questions from the audience. It's going to be really the craziest and the most awesome day of InnoTribe, the last one.
Now, you've got, Kevin, the other themes that you've got the future, the broad future. You're doing a lot on quantum this year as well, right?
Yeah, so I think if I look at the three themes, day one is decentralization as a new form of trust. And I think the key thing that you get if you get trust is access to data. Day two is quantum, because as data increases, even the fastest supercomputers in the world are struggling to sort of keep up with the amount of data that we're going to produce. So we're going to need a new way of doing that. And we think quantum computers is going to offer a way to create higher fidelity models with that enhanced data. And then once you've got data and you've got processing power, as one of the startups I've worked with in Israel says, you've essentially got a stack of needles. You're no longer looking for the needle in the haystack. You're looking for a needle in the needle stack. And so you're going to need advanced machine intelligence to actually be able to find that signal from the noise. And it's those three pieces together that's what we think are going to make that fundamental shift in society. But to Duana's point, that day four, it's all about the cybersecurity. How do you build this future state if you can't secure it? So one side of it is securing it. But the other side of security is the ethical side of it. It's the data privacy. If you can't actually respect people's data and respect their privacy, then you're not actually going to get it. They're not going to trust you, so you're not going to be able to do any of these things. So I think the cybersecurity coin has got the cyber, the defense, the attack on the one side of it, but you've got the data privacy on the other, and we're going to try and cover both of those on day four.
So, Duana, I'm interested in your view on all this as we talk about all this technology and being on the cutting edge of that. But as you say, it's about more than that. It's about the cultural changes. How are you seeing the cultural changes taking place? As you've been to Sibos many times yourself, and these are 8,000 of the largest global banks. How far along are we, and how much more do we have to go to change the culture, not just change the technology?
Well, that's an easy question. Let's start with that. We're very far. It's easy to get despondent, but it's also easy to get excited, depending on which part of the glass you want to look at. I believe that in banking, we're further than in other industries, sadly, to a degree. We see more and more in our consultancy, we see more and more of the other industries. We see pharma, we see aviation, we see other places in the world where they're a lot more open to the idea of people being more important than technology. I think in banking, we have a longer way to go, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to drop it. And I don't think we can drop it. What's happening essentially is we have all of this promise of technology that's getting greater by the day. We have these amazing avenues of delivering this technology, which is essentially the ways in which we work that are becoming smarter and more efficient by the day. And we can use neither of them to give the consumer a delightful end experience in banking until such a time that we have kind of cleaned house and made sure that the people in banking have their hearts and their minds in the right place. And it's a tall order. It's a difficult subject for bankers who are a lot more at ease speaking about numbers and P&Ls. But it's something that needs doing, and it needs doing as quick as humanly possible so that we can kind of deliver on all these amazing things happening in 2030. 2030 is not as far as it should be for the things that we still have on the backlog.
Well, you're right. Sorry, JP.
No, I was just going to say that's right. It's only 12 years away. And I was just interested in Katie's perspective as a futurist. What is the role of the human? What is the role of the manager in the future of work?
I think that it's changing dramatically compared to the way things have been. And it's going to be changing rapidly into the future as well. And that's really coming down to what ways we are going to be interacting with technology as a whole. And I think AI is going to open up a lot of doors for cooperating teams in ways that really aren't possible right now, but you're just starting to have those capabilities. And that's why it's changing company culture so much. And as a manager, you're going to be able to better assess what ideas are coming your way and kind of put together a greater scope of people's insights and information in ways that you just don't have right now. A lot of times right now, people will have, let's say, more fringe ideas in ways that they could better the business. And right now, there's a lot of roadblocks with that. I think that as a manager, you'll be able to better assess which of those more fringe ideas are worth pursuing as not, and instead of being put on the side or sidelined like they are today. So it's going to be changing a lot for sure.
So I guess I'm interested in the aspects, you know, both you and Duane can talk to this, Katie, but I'm interested in how AI changes the sort of structure of businesses like financial services, like banks. You know, obviously, 200 years we've been seeing technology, change the structure of labor force, farmers working on farms in the US being displaced by tractors, the steam engine with the Luddites, the textile workers before that, computers in more recent time. But AI is the first time we're actually going to disrupt human-based processes, stuff that we typically used to do, like, you know, risk management in the branch, compliance stuff, where it was there was a data component, but there was a lot of rules and procedure for humans to follow, and that's going to be disrupted by AI. So how well prepared do you think the industry is at large to cope with this shift, or, you know, is it too early to say?
I think, if I might, I'll just jump in for a second. I think right now we're being ridiculously infantile in banking when we talk about AI. We seem to think it's this thing that's going to just pick up the phone for us or do some of the unpleasant operations for us.
My AI is definitely going to do that.
As well, yes. I would hope it will, yes. But what we seem to gleefully kind of strive over is the fact that it's a lot deeper than that. And as you said, it's going to change the essence of how we've been working. To my mind, whether it's in 10, 20, or 30, or 50 years, what's going to be left as a job for a human is going to be intensely human of a job, if you will. It will be having to do with things that AI hasn't yet caught up with. All of the data bits are going to be taken care of, but the parts where you need to be someone with courage, you need to be someone with a lot of intuition, you need to be someone with purpose and passion, those parts hopefully are going to be not yet replicable by a machine. And what we need to teach our kids today is how to get those attributes into their thinking, how to move away from understanding how to multiply and move into understanding how to be empathic or how to collaborate or how to really have an idea and fight for it.
Now, Katie, maybe from a futurist perspective, you know, as a parent, how do you think about preparing your daughter for this future? You know, what sort of skills do you think is going to be important for kids growing up in this world?
Okay, so I'm going to answer both of those questions.
Okay.
The first one, they both tie in together. The big thing is that we're already seeing the changes taking place. It's happening through social media. Look at the way people react to the consumers. Look at the way the consumers react when they want something, it doesn't go their way. You know, you miss a flight, right? Let's say you're flying, just for an example, American Airlines. You end up on a flight that's overbooked, and now you don't have a way of getting home. You're frustrated. What is the first thing that people do nowadays? They turn to social media. They get on their phones, right, and right. They start typing, and they tweet to the company, right? So that's just an example of something in the future is going to be evolving, and AI has a really big part to do with it. And that's the future of democratization and decentralization. That is a huge part of it, is that there is going to be a better connection between the consumers and also the businesses. And this is just the beginning. Social media, this is just the start. It's just going to keep on growing, where I think in the future, the consumers will have a bigger part to play, because it will be the customer experience that will drive the need for innovation and change. And I think there'll be more of an open doorway than there is now between people at the top of businesses and people who are actually the customers and engaging with those products.
Well, I think a lot of that is just the tension between the micro and the macro. Brett, as you talk about the Luddites and the farmers and all of that, we've still had jobs for people. They're just different kinds of jobs. So it can be extremely painful in the micro. There will be people that need to prepare, and you've seen the old saw, and you futurists see this kind of stuff all the time, right? We have jobs that weren't even invented yet, and we're trying to prepare kids for jobs we don't even know what they're going to be 5 years or 10 years.
Like a robot psychologist.
Exactly. But over the long run, right, there, not to say that there aren't downsides, but it's probably a net win if we manage it right.
The thing is, we don't know where it is heading, but the best we can do is kind of just roll with the tide, see where it's going. And we do know that the gig economy is booming. I mean, talking to my daughter, if she was a little bit older and was approaching that age where she's going to be out and looking for a job, it's not the same way as it used to be. I don't think I would encourage my daughter to go for a college education. Perhaps I would. It depends on what you want to do, of course. There will be a need for it. But I think that unlike the past, even my generation, it's changing so much. I mean, nowadays, it's even in people who have skills and they're working online, and let's say they do editing, videography. That's my background. About 10 years ago, if you had a camera, that's what you could do, is you could shoot something and you could pitch it to the big team. They pick it up. But then came along YouTube. Now everyone's a filmmaker. When everyone became a filmmaker, then you have to learn how to shoot, how to edit, how to produce, how to write, how to do a little bit of everything. And I think that that's going to be a big part of how things will change in the future of work, is that you're going to need to know how to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, be adaptable.
And technology will help you do it.
I think that, you're not going to have a job for life. That's certainly the key. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time this week, but make sure if you're out in Vegas for Money 2020, make sure you say hello to JP and Jim and Jason Henricks and Ron Shevlin, who's going to be there. And if you're at Cybos in Sydney, make sure you come and say hello to Katie, Duaner, and myself as we discuss all things future in respect to banking, AI, quantum, and cyber security, et cetera. So that's it for the show this week. JP, what are we do a wrap-up show on Cybos and Money 2020 maybe next week? Or
yeah, so we're going to have the first of four segments coming up from Capital One. I think the first one's going to be Tom Poole and talking about what they're doing with virtual numbers, tokenization around mobile payments, and then we've got some others after that. But we've got quite a backlog, as you know, of great guests and great segments coming up over the next few weeks, so stay tuned.
Yeah, and we will be interviewing Joe Lubin from Ethereum out at Cybos and a bunch of other really smart people. So stay tuned for some of the content from Cybos as well. Kevin, Duaner, Katie, thanks for joining us on the show this week.
Thanks for having us.
Fantastic. All right, well, that's it for another Breaking Banks. Thanks for joining us. If you're out there in the world, don't forget, give us a review on iTunes or player.fm or wherever it is that you download the show from. Give us a shout out on social media. It helps other people find us and us to continue our reign as the number one global fintech podcast. That's Breaking Banks for another week. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.